My brother-in-law informed me at the end of service last weekend that my man card has been revoked. He and Josh Meyer came up to me. One is two strikes. Nate said, A, you never should do a sports analogy, and B, you would never reference Star Wars. A real man would never reference Star Wars in a sports analogy. Two strikes. And then Josh had a standing. He wears cardigans, and he has shoes with white soles. Three strikes. So that's been removed. I'm sure in Josh's mind it was removed a very, very long time ago, but in my mind it wasn't. Last week we talked about ancient Near East texts, specifically some examples from the law and law codes, and did a little comparison and contrast with the biblical texts. And today we're going to continue to examine, compare, and contrast some narratives of the ancient Near East with the biblical texts. And then we're going to do a little compare and contrast, and then talk about the competing worldviews and try to bring that all together with some further broad applications as we continue to go on in this series. So the first text that we're going to talk about is Atrahasis. That text dates to about the 17th century, although it probably originated earlier than that. And in many ways, the Atrahasis sort of represents a typical worldview of the Mesopotamian culture in terms of anthropology, sociology, and also cosmology, what their perspectives were on creation and the universe. The story of Atrahasis describes the origin of humanity and its relationship between the gods, and also talks about a cataclysmic flood. And according to the story, creation was divided into three chief gods, Anu, Enki, and Enlil. And Anu lived and reigned in the heavens, and Enki lived and reigned in the subterranean waters, and Enlil apparently lived on the earth. And then there was a cohort of lesser gods, and they were tasked with the digging of the life-giving canals, and they toiled for 40 years until they finally rebelled. And in response to their pleas, decided to allow the creation of human beings. Humans were formed through a mixing of clay and the blood of a slain god. And then they served in the lower places of they served in the grunt work of the lower deities. And as human beings became numerous, and this is where this ties into the Father's Day thing, because you'll start to relate here. As the human beings became numerous, like kids, right, they became noisy and they disturbed the sleep of the gods. So, I mean, even though these are pagan, horrible stories, there's a little bit of sympathy you have when you're hearing it. And so, particularly Enlil, because he was the god of the earth. And so, after successfully reducing the population through a number of plagues and famine, the gods then decided to completely wipe out human beings. And so, Enki, who was the subterranean god, who was more favorably disposed to human beings, warned Atrahasis. And in 7 days, Atrahasis built a boat and saved himself and animals and birds. So we can readily see that there are similarities between this myth and the biblical accounts of the creation and the flood. The Atrahasis and Genesis deal with the origin of human beings, the relationship to God or the gods, and then both of them, depict a cataclysmic flood in which divine intervention saves humans and animals. The second ancient Near East text that provides a helpful comparison to the biblical accounts is the Akkadian epic of creation, also known as the Enuma Elish. The Enuma Elish is widely believed to have been composed from Sumerian and Amorite stories during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. around 1126 to 11 BC, 1100 BC. And they were created to celebrate the accomplishments of the Babylonian kings and their chief god in the Babylonian pantheon, Marduk. And the existing manuscripts are sometime a little bit later than that, but date into the first millennium BC. The account begins with a reference to Apsu and Tiamat, two gods respectively representing sweet water and salt water, who existed, quote, when on high no name was given to heaven. This is as close to, and in the pagan myths, there isn't really a beginning to the universe. This is as close as you get to it. They mate, and their offsprings are born, and in turn, their offsprings reproduce, resulting in this growing cadre of gods. And it's in a similar way, these boisterous young gods are too much for are too much for Apsu, who determines to kill them. And upon learning of the plan, A casts a spell on Apsu, and then he is killed. And though Tiamat originally opposed her husband's plan to kill all the kids and grandkids, she took up that plan to honor his death. So these young gods that were in threat of losing their lives tried to find a leader, and they were unsuccessful until they made a deal with Marduk. And Marduk basically said that he would conquer their matriarch if they would allow him to be the king or the head of the pantheon, which is the culmination and group of the gods. So they agree, and Marduk kills the lady, the matriarch. I'm trying to figure out the best way to refer to her. Following the defeat of Tiamat, the other gods cede then some power to Marduk, and then he lays out the cosmos, and he does that with Tiamat's corpse. He creates the heavens and the earth. Marduk then establishes seasons and days and nights, and then he is finally proclaimed king of the gods. As king, Marduk then sets the gods who had been allied with his opponent to work and build Babylon, a city, a holy dwelling place for him. And then he later determines to create human beings to relieve those now slave gods of their toil. Marduk slays Tiamat's second husband, and he uses his blood and earth to make the human beings to do all the toil. And the epic ends with an extended exaltation of Marduk, proclaiming his 50 names, and the significance of the 50 names is that those are an accumulation of all the other gods' names, and gods, of course, served function. The Mesopotamian gods were not distinguished from the function that they represented, and we're going to get a little bit more into the division between Yahweh and these gods, and so Marduk had to, of course, share those titles because he had dominion. He was the head one. So as with Atrahasis, you can see the Enuma Elish has many parallels to Genesis 2. Both texts deal with the origin of the cosmos and the relationship to gods. And in addition, they describe the creation of human beings and the human beings' relationship with the gods. And then the final one, which is the most popular, is the Gilgamesh epic. And this epic is, you know, probably the most well-known and most striking in its parallel to the Old Testament. It recounts the exploits of a hero, Gilgamesh, who was widely believed to be an actual historical figure who reigned as king in roughly 28 to 2500 BC. The story of Gilgamesh are known to have existed in Sumer. The earliest copies of these texts are Sumerian, dating to the first half of the second millennium BC. And they exist in three forms: the Sumerian stories, an old Babylonian version, and what is considered by scholars the standard version, and that standard version is the best known one. And those early, the dates of those actual texts are around the first part of the first millennium, though those incorporate much materials that are much older. The main theme of Gilgamesh is his quest for immortality, and it basically traces that evolution or his aspect and his process. So, following the death of a companion, Gilgamesh goes out to seek immortality. He travels to the very ends of the earth, finds a survivor of the flood who has already achieved immortality. He continues to seek it. It doesn't become successful and ends up returning to his homeland, and there finds mortality in becoming a leader and preparing for the next generation and the heritage. And of course, when you're left with this limited worldview, that we can see that in our culture too, right? People are always talking about the next generation or the kids or some sort of narrow scope. The description of the flood narrative in the Gilgamesh epic has attracted the most attention to biblical scholars because it has obvious parallels to Genesis. As in Genesis, the hero of the flood in Gilgamesh receives divine warning of this impending flood and constructs a boat. Animals are brought into the boat to be saved. Following the flood, the hero releases birds. First he released a dove and it returns, then he releases a raven. And then he finds land and then offers sacrifices. Other parallels to this biblical account are found in Gilgamesh as well. Like, for instance, Gilgamesh learns of a plant during his quest that will grant him immortality. And with great joy, he takes the plant, but then it's carried off by a serpent. Thus, in Genesis and Gilgamesh, we find plants, humans, snakes, and the issue of eternal life. So even a brief description here of the legal text from last week and the narratives this week do reveal many obvious similarities between the ancient Near East texts and the biblical accounts. And such similarities have led some scholars to conclude that essentially the biblical materials are largely borrowed from the ancient Near East materials. Some argue that the biblical account of creation, for example, represents little more than an ancient Israelite sort of spin on the mythical account of creation that you find in the Enuma Elish or the Atrahasis. Similarly, the legal material in the Pentateuch is sometimes seen as reflecting the same sorts of patterns and values of the ancient Near East legal codes, and we talked about that a little bit last week. So, on this sort of superficial reading, how are we supposed to react to this stuff? Should we conclude that the biblical texts have just simply been adopted from the ancient Near East just to sort of fit into Israelite sensibilities, or are there other possibilities? Well, we should note first that similarities between the materials are really not all that surprising. I think when I first stumbled across this stuff, because I wasn't thinking very seriously about it, I was shocked, and then I realized that it had more to do with my perception of how the Bible has been created than it did about the actual similarities here, because I perhaps thought that I perhaps had a wrong connotation of the word being zapped from out of nowhere, sort of a dictation theory. And so initially this stuff first really bothered me. But we know that the Israelites were part of the ancient Near East world, and these texts consequently would reflect the worldview of their social environment. There would be some similarities. Just as other ancient peoples reflected on the question of creation and the activity of the gods. I mean, these are universal concepts. The fact that there are similarities shouldn't shock anyone. It would be the same. Here's another poor analogy, but a little bit better in the world I'm working in. There are tons of Marvel movies. At some point, they have to share certain motifs, even though some characters in those motifs and those shows are radically different with regard to their power and what they can do. But there are some shared things. And so in a culture, we would have that, much like we would here if we were telling a story to someone else, and we would use common language and common expressions. You know, the Israelites, the law addressed similar situations that we talked about last time. Part of the law was to maintain order, right? It wasn't just that, and wasn't only that, and that wasn't the primary piece, but obviously that is not a consequence. And for the ancient Near East and the pagan construction of laws, that was primarily their order. So there's going to be some similarities there. But I would suggest strongly that these similarities are vastly overrated and that they're at a super and that they're at a some form of high level. And when we start digging down into the text and have careful readings, we really get to see significant differences in the text. In fact, I'd say at several points, it may be argued that the biblical texts are directly engaging in the ancient Near East texts. And in order to refute them, remember we talked about the polemic last time, this sort of formal argument against a position. And this, I think, biblical authors are often employed. In fact, I'll read you a quote from one of the books that was suggested for me to read. It's called Against the Gods by John Kirk. Really fantastic book. A lot of good examples of the compare and the contrast and the details of the differences between them. And it's a very encouraging book, and I would highly recommend. It's a great resource to have. And this quote from John: polemical theology is the use by biblical writers of the thought forms and stories that were common in ancient Near East culture, while filling them with radically new meaning. The biblical authors take well-known expressions and motifs from the ancient Near East milieu and apply them to the person and work of Yahweh and not the other gods in the ancient world. So similarly then, it's not the, the similarity is not the end of the matter. And it's nor something that should easily trouble you as you work through the material. So a close examination here then of the creation accounts of Genesis, the Enuma Elish, and the Atrocitus shows some striking contrast. The creation account in Genesis appears to know the ancient Near East accounts and seeks to refute them, like we just talked about. In Genesis, everything worshipped as gods by ancient Near East people is created by Yahweh, the God of Israel. Moreover, Yahweh creates through the power of his word. Conflict among then gods does not create creation, as in the Enuma Elish. But in Genesis, Yahweh creates on his own. Whereas in the Enuma Elish, A uses words to powerfully cast spells on Apsu and thereby killing him. In Genesis, Yahweh uses words to make worlds appear. The Enuma Elish, the earth is literally part of the divine, having been fashioned by Marduk from the corpse, if we remember that story. In Genesis, the earth is a reflection of Yahweh's intentionality, but it is no way part of the divine realm. So, for instance, in this graph, there are similarities in these stories, but I've highlighted a couple of contrasts here. And we're going to get into this a little bit more, but in the Enuma Elish, it's a closed system. Divine spirits and cosmic matter coexist and are co-eternal. And in Genesis, Yahweh is separate from that. And with regard to creation, light emanating from the gods is an example of the functionality of the gods. In pagan cultures, gods were they weren't distinct from the thing that they did. And with Yahweh and the Old Testament, God creates something that's very cool, but is not him, and it does not define him. In addition, Yahweh is utterly in control of the events of creation. So, for instance, he's not even surprised that Noah survived the flood, since he ordered it and commanded the construction of the ark for the preservation of Noah's family and the animals. And in Genesis 7:16, he actually shuts the door. This is in contrast to the Gilgamesh story, where they create the flood, but it terrifies the gods. And most of the gods have to rely on A to understand how to save them or how to stop it. And again, the gods of the ancient Near East are dependent on human sacrifices. So in Atrocitus, when he lands on, when the water recedes and he lands and he gives sacrifices, the gods scurry over to consume the sacrifice because they're dependent upon it. And so within the story, this is not a infinite and eternal being who's all powerful and exists without us or before us and independent of us. These are stories of just basically projections of what we would like to think of ourselves. So this is a radically different perspective. And the creation of human beings and the relationships of God, touched on that a little bit in Babylonian text here. Human beings were created to relieve them from the drudgery of work. They're just created to be slaves. And when they get to be too annoying, they're eliminated. In contrast, in Genesis, Yahweh actively creates. Work is not drudgery to be avoided, but it's an act of a sovereign God. He creates human beings in his image, right? And is understood and is suggesting that they will serve as his representatives on earth. They are not insignificant beings created to relieve Yahweh of the drudgery of work, but they're creatures that really are the pinnacle of creation and the ones that are privileged to be his image bearers and to represent him and to be stewards of all that he's made. So, stark contrast. The flood narrative further illustrates the significance in human beings in Genesis. In Genesis, Yahweh himself commanded human beings to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth. A populous earth was a sign of obedience to the cultural mandate, to the divine command. It's the exact opposite of these temporary gods who find them a nuisance because they're too many. So human beings matter in Genesis. They just simply do not matter in these other accounts. And even the superficial similarities appear to be sort of deliberately reworded in order to make a theological point. For instance, both in Genesis and Gilgamesh, the narrative accounts of humanity are using certain thematic themes, elements. Snakes, humans, living plant. And I noted before that the snake steals the plant of immortality from Gilgamesh. In Genesis, however, these same elements have totally different significance. The loss of the tree of life is not an unfortunate accident. It's a result of sin, of a moral failure that God has a standard for. It's not just some cosmic thing that happens. And so it's possible, if not even likely from scholars, that that Moses may be seeking to persuade his listeners who are familiar with the Gilgamesh story that it's Genesis, not Gilgamesh, that gets it right here. What's the real reason why humans are suffering and die? These differences all point to the fact that the Pentateuch conceives of Yahweh as an entirely different God. Now, to be sure, the gods of the ancient Near East are powerful, but they're not particularly moral, as we talked about, and they're not all powerful. They're more powerful than humans, but there's no sense of transcendence on the parts of these gods. In contrast, Yahweh is a transcendent, moral, and all-powerful creator. John Walton, who I'll give the disclaimer, Denny, because Denny said, I like this book, and Denny said, well, you got to be careful. John's may not be in the same lane as we are, so that's the disclaimer, but this is a fantastic book. A lot of really good background and resources. He says this, the radical nature of the biblical worldview may be seen when comparing the creational system envisioned in the ancient Near East and biblical creation accounts. The ancient Near East cosmologies all presupposed a closed system in which gods, humans, and nature all exist together. There is nothing outside of that created order in which gods, humans, and nature all coexist. The biblical depiction of creation is very different. There, Yahweh is transcendent. He intervenes in events within the created order, but is outside of it. The forces of nature are under his control, not only because he created them, because he's not in it. He's outside of it. So he's never overwhelmed by the power of nature like the gods in the ancient Near East are. He's not subject to spells like they were. This system's, and so the best illustration of that would be this. And this is the big high-level piece to take away from today. The ancient Near East worldview is closed. All three of these elements coexist. And that is in direct, significant conflict with the fact that God is outside of the system, although he is interacting with it. Now, I think when evangelicals and when we read the Old Testament, we really just simply do not understand how radically different this was. We're talking about thousands of years of the, on your left, right? The vision on the left being the predominant worldview. It's not like reading the Old Testament in 22nd century America. The stories used with similar concepts and similar elements were totally turned on their head. Why? Because the Pentateuch and the Old Testament is about Yahweh. Primarily, it is about him. And everything details the distinction between the creator, the all-powerful and independent creator of the universe, and all of these contingent beings on this other side. And so when we read the Old Testament and we come across sections like I said last week that strike us as odd, we run into neo-atheists who start making claims that these things are all the same. When we dig down a little bit further, and if you're convicted to do so, for instance, it's not good to just hold things. You need to exhaust resources and to understand whether they're worth holding. At some point, you may have to hold something that you can't have an answer to, but putting yourself in turmoil, like a superficial reading of these competitive texts and then deciding that's going to rock your world a little bit with your faith means that you need to do a little bit more homework. So essentially what we're talking about here is understanding that it's revelation from Yahweh. It's distinct and absolutely different from this, and any similarities need to be digged down a little bit more to understand that the similarities actually play to highlight the differences. They're actually used to turn them on their head. And so I think studying this stuff is really fun for me in this book because it was a richer experience of understanding just the contrast. And then hopefully when we do that through this series, we come away with a deeper understanding of who he is. Thanks. Yep, I'm good.